Yes, this is Tom.
Yeah, this is Robert Stark. So I am joined here with Tom Sunick, and Charles Lincoln is going to be joining us shortly. Hey, Charles.
Hello.
Hey, Charles, you're on the air. Let me introduce the show. So where we left off last time, we were talking about Tom Sunick's upcoming speeches in Southern California. And just to give a brief introduction to Tom, he was a professor at UCSB and at Cal State Fullerton. Is that correct?
Right.
And
that's true.
And a cultural attaché to the Republic of Croatia. And this show, we're going to be focusing on the topic of the new right in Europe. But first of all, I want to make an announcement. Tom Sunick has a speech planned out in Santa Barbara, where I am, and this speech is going to be, it's going to be on the 19th. Charles, do you want to, you helped organize this. Charles, do you want to give the details for that speech, and then we can move on to the topic of the new right?
Yes, it's going to be in downtown Santa Monica, not Santa Monica, downtown Santa Barbara at the Coppola's Manuscript Library, 21 Anapamu Street, near Chapala, and the doors will open at 6 o'clock. We'll have a little reception, and Dr. Sunick will start speaking at 7 o'clock. It's basically, it's open to absolutely everybody, no admission. And we will not be doing any fundraising, although it is sponsored by the American Freedom Party and law office of William Johnson. And then there's also going to be an event that I really want people to start spreading the word on, because we didn't get quite as many ads as I would have liked organized. And that's in Beverly Hills at 9930 Santa Monica on Sunday, 2 days later, on Sunday at the gym, Beverly Hills Gym Community Center, 9930 Santa Monica, starting at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that's going to be interesting, because we will actually have another speaker. Dr. Sunick will be appearing, and then there will be a discussion with Luke Ford. And the topic, basically, we're going to be focusing on that one on the ethnic relations, I guess, because the GEM Center is of course a Jewish community center, and they're very interested in the similarities between the confrontation between Christians and Muslims in the former Yugoslavia, and what the Israeli people are facing in relation to being surrounded by Islamic people in the Near East. So I think I was hoping that we could have a longer session today, but Dr. Sunick, since we can't, would you just tell us a little bit about your personal history and how you came to be, in particular, a director of the American Freedom Party?
Well, I will try to keep my answers as sharp and to the point as possible. First, guys, let me thank you for setting up those venues, and thank you, Charles Olson, thank you, Robert, for organizing those meetings, and I'm certainly looking forward to it. And, okay, now, as far as the American Freedom Party is concerned, I'm glad that this is being sponsored, those venues, by American Freedom Party and by my good friend, my colleague, the lawyer William Johnson, and also my other colleagues, and I hope that they will show up in force at those venues as well. Now, being myself, I am also a U.S. citizen. Of course, I've never belonged to any party whatsoever. And in my view, as far as the American Freedom Party is concerned, I think it's a good alternative to the present political establishment in the United States of America. I think I can tell you quite frankly, I'm doing that on a purely voluntary basis, and most of the people on board are directors, including my good friend Kevin McDonald. We are doing that primarily because we want to foster, we want to actually promote the issue of, let's put it bluntly, of white disenfranchised, of rights actually being outcast, so to speak. And what we are basically doing, me and Kevin McDonald, we are trying to specifically target this issue of white guilt and this self-hate, or self, if I can put it that way. And again, we are doing that on a primarily intellectual and cultural level, not so much on an activist, on a political level. And yes, indeed, we have lots of shortcomings. We need more. We need more members, and certainly need normal members. We just don't want to have people who consider membership in the American Freedom Party as some sort of a hobby or some sort of a leisure. No, no, no. It's a hard work, and I'm very much committed to it, let alone that I'm also anticipating. That's a different subject matter we can discuss about this. I certainly wouldn't mind relocating back to the States and being of some service to our people and to our cause.
First of all, I want to start with the basics. Let's try to define the new right and the terminology of the new right. Most people in basically everyone, almost everyone in the United States has never heard of the term new right. They might hear new right. They might even think, oh, that sounds like a synonym for neoconservatism. So I think the first step is, we'll get into the details, but can you give a sort of very broad, like a very sort of basic definition, or to a person who's never heard of the new right in Europe?
All right, Robert, let me just clarify a couple of methodological points, if I can put it that way. I certainly will have a couple of venues and a couple of speeches in LA, in the LA area. And among other things, I'll be talking about the etymology of the word of the new right, and of course about this cultural movement, the new right in Europe, and I will make some comparisons with the American new right, and then I will talk in my next speech will be devoted to Islam and to the history of Islam, particularly in the Balkans. And the third one, I think, is on the European Union. So I guess for your readers, for your listeners, it might be good, it might be appropriate to pinpoint those issues and focus on them separately. Now, as far as the new right is concerned, I must say this is more or less of a misnomer. And let me just say briefly about the history of the new right. The term was launched in the early 70s in the left-leaning leftist press in the media in France, and this was actually the term used for the description of a group of thinkers and scholars in France, including my good friend Alain de Benoist, who were aiming at restoring the European, if I can put it, a cultural conservative heritage. And I must also emphasize that the new rightists in Europe never call themselves new rightists. For that matter, there is an official expression that they use as their logo and in their different publications in French, which is in French, Groupement de Recherche et d'Etudes pour la Civilisation Européenne, which means literally in English, the grouping or the group of people for the research and study of the European civilization. Now, it was their detractors, I must emphasize that, their enemies who use this term, the new right. An additional problem with this expression, the new right, is that in America, the new right is often associated with neocons, with neoconservatives. And I must tell right at the beginning that the neoconservatives or the new right in Europe, you know, think about Horitz, think about the journal A Commentary or Forward, or even to some extent the New Republic, the journal, they have absolutely nothing in common with the European New Right. In fact, I may almost say that they're hostile to each other because they advocate completely two different issues.
They're almost polar opposites.
They're polar opposites. This is the right expression. I'm glad, Mr. Stark, that you mentioned that. That's Robert. That's exactly the word. And I can, of course, I plan to develop this issue a little bit more in my first lecture in Santa Barbara. Now, let me briefly summarize the main points that the new right is advocating. Now, first we have the critique of egalitarianism, Then we have the critique of economism. This is the French neologism, so I must explain it. The belief in progress, the belief in whole economy is basically something that the new right in Europe has been very, very critical of. And then, of course, there's the critique as well, and criticism, not just critique, but criticism of the idea of progress. And to some extent, and yes, this is probably the most controversial part, they're also critical of monotheism. In other words, Alain de Benoist, who is the main figure, the main philosopher, well known all over Europe, he actually argues and he claims that the monotheism and its secular offshoots, like Christianity, Judaism, I'm sorry, monotheism, which is embedded in those three main monotheistic religions, including Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. He argues that their secular offshoots are liberalism and communism. And basically, if you truly want to understand the danger or the disease of communism and liberalism, we have to go further down and explore the monotheistic origins. Now, he has written literally lots of books about this issue, but what I find particularly fascinating is his critique and his criticism of postmodernity. Now, let me just for your listeners explain a couple of points that may be of some interest. Now, there is nothing really that new about the new right. Some of your listeners who may be familiar with the prose of Friedrich Nietzsche or Nietzsche will probably be on the right path. Because if you're familiar with Friedrich Nietzsche or some other big thinkers from the 19th century, then of course you will understand what this quote unquote new right stands for. Now, if by that mean, now there is an interesting thing which I also want to bring up during my discussion in Santa Barbara, and these are antebellum, or other, I'm sorry, these are thinkers. Antebellum thinkers, you can say, and their successors, the intellectual successors known as Southern agrarians. Now, Southern agrarians were prominent conservative thinkers in the early 30s from the Tennessee University. And you'd be surprised, it's absolutely fascinating to find out how those people were actually, under quotation marks, predecessors of what the new right now stands for in Europe.
And
So,
yeah,
in
I
fact,
know Charles is going to have a lot to say about that topic because he has the whole Southern background. He's interested in that.
well, I'm just
Absolutely,
intrigued
because
that I'm intrigued that you bring it up because my freshman year in college, which is, an embarrassingly long time ago these days, it was 1975 to 76, I took a course in English from Professor Cleanth Brooks. I don't know if you know that name, but he was one of the agrarians. He was one of the there's several names for that group out of Vanderbilt, but he was teaching at Tulane University in retirement. He retired from Yale to Tulane, and his presentation of basically 20th century literature as reaction to the disintegration of civilization was really one of the major formative things in my life, and so I'm very happy that you brought that up because very few people are aware of the Southern agrarians. And what was the other term they
I'm
used for
glad Charles is
themselves?
jumping on.
The refugees.
I'm sorry, I didn't
No.
follow. What was that? I didn't hear well.
Oh,
I'm
I was just
sorry.
saying. Do you know the name Cleanth Brooks, Professor Cleanth Brooks, as a member of that group? I don't know who all
It may sound familiar, but
Robert.
I
I
must
think we're
say, and
having
I
some.
certainly don't want to. Just go ahead. Yes. Can you guys hear me well?
We seem to be. Yeah, I'm not hearing you very well. I think
Well, I
we're
can
having
hear
a
both of
sound
you,
problem.
so I think for now we can get back to this topic later, but let me ask you, okay, so you have the new right. What exactly is the old right? Are some people going to say that the old right is in reference to things like fascism? And what do you say to the argument that the new right is the inheritor to, or not, I wouldn't say a clone of fascism, but an ideological descendant of fascism. What would your response be to people who say that?
That's a very good point indeed, Robert. I'm glad that you brought this up because at the beginning of my discussion in Santa Barbara, when I start talking about the new right, after all, I mean, in parentheses, I got to add that this was my doctoral dissertation at UCSB on the new right and the etymology of the word. I will be talking first about those semantic shifts, which I think are probably the most important portion of my discussion. What do I mean by semantic shifts? Of course, the enemies of the detractors of the current new right in Europe, particularly the left-leaning scholars or the communist-leaning scholars, the liberal-leaning scholars, including some scholars in the United States of America, just flatly accuse the new right thinkers of being proto-fascist or archaeo-fascist or resuscitating some sort of a historical revisionism. Now, listen, this is all labeling, and I don't want to get involved in it. It's one thing what I think about myself, it's the other thing what either my enemies or my interlocutors think about me. Now, I plan to keep my lecture very, very subdued, and I'm not going to get involved in some polemical issues. Now, back to your question. There is no question that the new right leaders and thinkers are interested in resuscitating or reviving, what's the better word, or reliving authors and thinkers, including the southern agrarians in the United States of America, dear friends, including people from the antebellum South who, for a variety of reasons, and mostly political reasons and politically correct reasons, have disappeared from our school curriculum, period. And this is something that wanna actually, where they've been intellectually involved, including myself. Why don't we just read a little bit more authors from the late 30s, early 30s, not just in the United States, but also in Europe and other parts, and see what those authors, not just in the field of genetics or in the field of biology, but also in the field of literature, also in the field of philosophy, had to say. And I will tell you that as a former professor and still as a professor, that unfortunately our school curriculum, be it at the UCSB, or that matter UCLA and anywhere in the world, has been completely revamped. And I hate to say that it has been changed and recycled by left-leaning and proto-communist and cultural Bolsheviks, if I can say, which I find particularly harmful for young students. They should be able, the young students at any university, any college, again, I repeat, not just in the United States, but also in Europe, to be exposed to different thinkers, and then they can themselves make an executive decision. Well, this guy appeals to me. What Charles just said very well, and I'm fascinated what he said. It's incredibly important. How many American scholars, let alone how many American college students from the Tennessee University, what do they know about I'll Take My Stand? What do they know about the massive amount of intellectual legacy of Southern agrarians? What do, for instance, many students, even next door to where I live here in Croatia, in Austria, what do they know about the massive cultural conservative revolution? I'm not talking in political terms. I'm talking about in cultural terms. What do they know about their cultural heritage? Zilch. They know nothing. Of course, I'm probably simplifying things a little bit. But keep in mind that after the Second World War, for a variety of reasons, many, many authors from all fields in humanities have disappeared from the libraries.
And the other issue I'll ask you is you talk about, you come from an anti-communist background, but I've noticed a lot of people who come from, and who are from countries, especially Cubans, but also some Russians and Eastern Europeans who come to the United States, a lot of them, they despise communism so much, but they tend to embrace things like corporations and the Republican Party and stuff like that, which they see as the opposite of communism. But you're also very critical of corporations and consumerism and well, I guess Charles isn't going to like this, but what some people might describe as capitalism. Though Charles, I know you're going to dispute that term, but in a colloquial sense, what a lot of people describe as capitalism, the new right has a critique of.
Absolutely, and I don't mind talking and even arguing with our friend Charles. And in fact, I'm always pleased to engage my interlocutors even in hostile discussions, as long as if it's well argued, as long as there's no violence involved. I must tell you, I've studied this very much. In fact, I spent my whole life just dealing with and reading and writing and examining this mystique, the Marxist mystique, and its secular outcome in communism and Bolshevism. But then I must also admit the fact that before we studied the consequences of the Gulag and the Gulag sewage system, we also got to look at how it all started, you know. And of course, we see a great many philosophical common points between liberalism, or let's call it capitalism, and communism, namely the belief in progress. And this is something I plan to address at my lecture in Santa Barbara, and also the concept of linear history. You know, Marx talks about the dialectical history, like linear in a sense that things will always be better in the future. At some point, the future will unfold in this multicultural, multiracial embrace. Now, the irony of history is that I must emphasize that many of those communistic idea, or rather Marxist ideas, have been better implemented now in the United States of America than in Western Europe than in the Soviet Union. And this is the ultimate irony of history. Like ethnic sensitivity training in the United States of America, affirmative action. I experienced that in communist Yugoslavia a long, long time ago. It ended up in a civil war. You
That
know, that's why I'm a little.
is what I mean. Some people use the terminology cultural Marxism. That's the Frankfurt School, but I would make a distinction. I think the term Marxist is confusing. I would make a distinction between the Frankfurt School and Karl Marx himself, because a lot of people who subscribe to the Frankfurt School, a lot of them have actually abandoned economic Marxism. And I did a show with Paul Gottfried on that, and I mean we discussed that if you want to look that up. But I think the using the term Marxist can be misleading. I think it's important to make a distinction between Karl Marx and the Frankfurt School. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, you remember what I said earlier, those semantic shifts. We certainly do not want to extrapolate someone's words. Like you mentioned, Paul Gottfried, he's, by the way, a good friend of mine. You know, it was my old mentor 30 years ago when I lived in Pennsylvania. Anyway, it's a long story. But the fact is, I just don't want to put my words into someone else's mouth. There's no question that Marx had some very good pieces and very good paragraphs in his description of this capitalist ugliness. You know, let's imagine. I mean, we don't even need to go that far. You just have to read the contemporary novelist of his, Charles Dickens, and just to get the flavor of what London, the capitalist London, looked like in the mid 19th century, when Marx also lived there. Now, I'm pretty much sure that if Marx were to be resuscitated, if he were now reincarnated in all modern society, he would probably be the first one to attack, you know, the legacy of communism and what the communism all left behind. But the fact of the matter is that you guys, you will all agree that good ideas, possibly even mine, I don't know. I mean, I can just take a wild guess. Good ideas can sometimes have disastrous consequences. I understand that even if I.
I'll give you an example
Yes.
of Karl Marx. Marx's theories was that basically labor is a supply, and the more you increase the supply of labor, the lower the demand for labor goes. And that totally counters the argument that the modern day left uses for immigration. So that's an issue where Marx, a lot of Marx's theories were right, but they're not. They've actually been abandoned by the modern left.
Absolutely.
I'm
Well,
not
let's
sure
call
you
it
quite got
nice
Marx's
culture.
theory of labor.
Charles, you want to go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, I'm not sure. I'm not quite comfortable with that as a representation of Marx's theory of labor. But anyhow, I wanted to get back to the point of the New Right, and particularly your talk about resuscitating discussions that were going on in the 1930s. And you had mentioned, "I'll take my stand," and that was published in 1930, of course. And one of the members of that was Robert Penn Warren, and if anybody in the audience has ever read any of the Southern Agrarians, they've probably read something by Robert Penn Warren. Most likely, they've read his books that are basically based on the life of Huey Long, All the King's Men, for instance. And Huey Long I wonder if you have any comments to make about Huey Long and sort of his presentation of what was really the third way in the early 30s, and it was snuffed out, of course, by probably politically motivated assassination in 1935, but that became the basis for sort of, you know, southern thinking, southern political thinking and resistance. And
yes, well,
I was just wondering if you could comment a little bit more about that, the 1930s origin of the Third Way. Another name that might be we haven't mentioned yet is the name of Ezra Pound. Basically, people who were sympathetic to those who opposed both the American way and the Russian way, because they were related by concepts of international banking.
Yes,
I was wondering if you
could
develop any of those thoughts.
I'm glad that you brought this at this point, and I, you know, here we have another irony of history, quote unquote, the most radical, under quotation marks, anti-Americans were Americans, like Ezra Pound, and like even the Southern Agrarians. And they sometimes fit more into this European environment, into this modern American environment. But again, those people who are to be blamed are, I call them the masters of oblivion, or call them masters of discourse, who have purposely removed that prose from the from library shelves and from the student curriculum. What do people know about, of course, when they talk about Ezra Pound? They only, you know, quote some of his anti-Semitic statements during his radio shows here in a fascist Italy. But other than that, he also wrote poems on usury. He wrote poems, fascinating poems, you know, full of verve and intellectual depth about banking systems. So he was truly a man of amazing erudition. Now, you mentioned also, you know, we have tackled so many names, and I am afraid of dropping too many names. You have put the name of Huey Long. Unfortunately, he has also
yes.
been vilified, you know, by the liberal press after the Second World War, Huey Long. Look, he died relatively young, in his 40s and so on. I'm not ruling out precisely he was an anti-communist, because every sane and normal person must be an anti-communist. For me, this is not a hobby. I mean, we know what the sociology of it's a pathology, basically, communism.
Well, you lived
but
under
again,
it.
He was.
Well,
yes, I lived. So I will talk about this more, about the psychology of communism, why it's so appealing. You know, don't. There's it's also an appealing side of it. But you know, the good side of Huey Long is that he also understood the banking system. He also understood that there were people who were bankrolling. You know, the communists. He actually lived it during that epoch. So communism in the Soviet Union did not drop from the moon. Consider the fact that there were I think 150, 60 people, the early Bolsheviks, including Trotsky, who were American citizens and who came to early Russia to upstage the revolution. So anyway, we don't want to get involved in all those nitty-gritty details, but there are many, many things. The devil isn't in the detail. But as far as the... You know, one thing I feel sorry about, because probably my advantage is that I can put myself in two different perspectives, the European perspective and the U.S. perspective. In the United States of America, as Charles very well said, there is such a huge intellectual legacy, and I'm sometimes really shocked, and I guess it's a crime on the part of professors, you know. How come they never dish out to their students this literature from the South, from the antebellum South, so that students... here's the name that comes to me, George Fitzhugh. George was a great lawyer, great guy of the Renaissance knowledge. He's completely unknown. He wrote books about the quote-unquote this multiracial ecumenism that are still fascinating today, that are incredibly, incredibly modern. George Fitzhugh, right? I'm quoting him in my book, Homo Americanus. So there are many others that I can learn from, and I'm sure Charles can probably help us out. And by and large, you know, you mentioned this guy, Ezra Pound, but there are dozens of other, you know, great American scholars who have completely disappeared from the map. So again, back to the European New Right. The European New Right, I need to state it firmly, folks, this is not a political party. It's not a political movement. It's just an intellectual sensibility. And this sensibility can be found among many American scholars, authors, novelists, even, you know, if you wish, this guy, I would wish I could give a lecture on that, on what is this great poet, you know, he's constantly cited and quoted by the European New Right in Europe. Just a second, I can't think of it. Anyway, so, you know, this is what the New Right is all about. It's just about the resuscitation of reliving or remodeling, if I can put it that way, of our intellectual heritage, which for a variety of reasons is called the right-wingish heritage or conservative heritage. The reason I am a little bit suspicious of this word conservative, because what's to be conserved in the first place? So that's the reason for, you know, we need to use this word new right, which is a very clumsy word to start with.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the term right. I hear new right, the alternative right, but I would actually prefer that people just drop that term altogether. That's my opinion.
Absolutely, I agree with you. But again, short of something better, we got to resort to this word.
But Tom, I mean, you know, I'd like you to speak a little bit about to what's going on in Croatia right now. And, you know, you mentioned the other day in a private conversation we had that you had found yourself sort of, you know, a victim of the critique of political correctness, I think was the word you used. And that, of course, is something that I don't know if you saw it on Facebook, but Robert was caught in sort of a hailstorm the past couple of days, where he had asked people to be civil. He had asked people to be civil and not use epithets in discussions and not make categorical discussions. And he got like 1,000 people
almost
responding
1,000.
To him within
it was
24
over,
hours.
Over 800.
Well, it was a very unusual thing that happened on Facebook, and basically it goes to this issue of censorship and political correctness.
I wouldn't say it's unusual. Basically, that's Facebook is you have people constantly bickering back and forth.
Well, okay, Robert. It's fairly unusual in my experience to see any of us to stir that kind of. I wanted Tom to comment on what political correctness meant in Croatia, and you know how we can compare that, because I guess what I thought the new right was I thought it was sort of a term that was referring to these rising third parties. Such as the Front National in France, the UKIP, you know the Italian social movement, things like that. But you're saying it's more of an intellectual thing. But do you have a comment about a perspective on the political dimensions of the new right-wing parties in Europe, and this concept of censorship and political correctness? Since you're talking about how people, you know, the academic world has basically censored most of the early 20th century, and that's a pretty interesting concept in itself.
All right. There are a couple of, you know, issues that we need to distinguish here, Charles, and I'm glad that you have brought this point up. Now, first, there is a political correctness in the political forum, in the political arena, and there is also political correctness in academia. The New Right has written extensively about this, and all those people to some extent affiliated with the New Right have literally published dozens of books and dozens of titles on censorship, on censorship, on on this soft type of a totalitarianism going on in Europe and elsewhere in the so-called free West. And again, I don't know where to start. In fact, I've written and I've talked about this very extensively. I've published, pieces on political correctness and self-censorship in both French and German and English and different journals in a more or less, academic fashion. Now, let me tell you one thing. For me, as the censorship and this, let's call it soft totalitarianism, is absolutely nothing new because I grew up in communist Yugoslavia, except for one thing, which I certainly will bring up at my venues. This is another irony of history, folks, that the advantage of living in communism was, quite explicitly, that you could tell exactly who your foe was and who your friend was. Because communism was so ugly, so dirty. I mean, even physically, even morphologically, even a person, even an illiterate person, if I can put it that way, even a person not necessarily well educated, who could tell right away who was the communist hack in his neighborhood, who was the communist spy, because the communism was basically a mendacity, a system of mendacity 24 hours, 7 days a week. And every person could tell right away. Well, those guys are bad people. We got to get rid of them. However, this is the problem with this soft type of liberal totalitarianism. It's better hidden, it's veiled, it's more insidious. It doesn't kill the body, it kills the soul, which is even worse. And I noticed that in American academia, and I've noticed that in French academia. Recently, I was supposed to get an invitation from a prestigious university near Bonn from a former friend of mine who was a visiting prof in the States. In Pennsylvania in the 90s when I was still there, and I, for a variety of reasons, the dean canceled that. I can send you the link because I did not fit into this category of politically correct people, and given the multiracial environment of the university, they were scared of having some hecklers and so on and so forth. So Tom Sunnick was written off. This is what I think is far worse. It doesn't, this new thought police, I'm sure you're familiar with this expression. They don't need to use truncheons. They don't need to use the Gulag sewage system. They can shut you up in a much more decent, in a far more elegant way. Hence the reason I don't get a tenure in the United States of America, which I'm sorry about.
One thing I've noticed about the European about Europe and European movements is because of these speech laws, the European activists are much more careful how they word stuff. But in a sense, that's actually a positive thing because in America, there's a superficial sense of freedom of speech where, yeah, I mean, you're not going to go to jail for what you say, but there's still economic consequences. But I've noticed the American, if you want to call them equivalents, go ahead. But I've noticed people in America are often a lot more crude how they word things. Have you noticed that?
Well, I would, yes, I agree with you partially, yes. But as far as the crudeness is concerned, I think it's probably the other way around. Europeans tend to be much cruder and much more ideological and much more polemical. Yes, indeed, the United States of America still has the First Amendment, guys, and you've got to be proud of it. And of course, here in Europe, I also got to be careful how I frame my discussion, not just as a former diplomat, but even in a public appearances, even when I have lectures and talks, I get invitations, and I always have to make sure that there are certain themes that I would never tackle openly, for obvious reasons. I mean, such as, for instance, the Jewish question and, of course, the immigration question. I know, of course, in the United States, it's the same
Well,
thing,
the
particularly
first
in
one,
academia.
hold, for a second there, the first one, that issue was obviously very taboo. But you're saying the second one, the immigration question, you're saying it's just as taboo or almost as much?
It is. It just depends. Of course, you can very generally, as I often do, you can criticize immigration from the sociological point of view, because I got to use some leeways. Quite frankly, folks, I cannot just say and put my finger on the Somalis or for the turn on the Turks or for and say explicitly. Everybody knows that, but everybody pretends not to know that. Let me put it that way. Let me give you some statistics. Over 50% of Austrian of inmates in Austria, which is a neighboring country, like 1.5 hour drive from here where I live. 50% of inmates are of non-Austrian origin. They're foreigners, they're immigrants. There is a very high crime rate, particularly among immigrants, and not just so many from Europe, but from other non-European countries. In Germany, likewise. In Belgium, it has 60% of not just petty criminals, but just big time criminals, you know, come from non-European countries, and even some huge crimes are being committed by people of non-European background. But once they start theorizing this in open, once they start, with racial profiling, everybody knows that, even cops that I know of, but for a variety of reasons, they don't want to talk about this. Now, I understand that things are, well, of course, they may be a little bit better on the legal level, the judicial level in the United States of America, but basically they are more or less the same, which brings me to my first conclusion, actually, my first and last conclusion, namely, multiculturalism doesn't work, and the so-called liberal free society is basically not a free society. It doesn't allow free speech. It actually clamps down on you, and it doesn't have to kill you, but you can lose your job, you lose your promotion, and the different methods being employed against nonconformists. And I consider myself, by my genes, a nonconformist. I'm a dissident, and I will just as well disagree with somebody, you know, a right winger, if you wish, if I, for a variety of reasons, if I think that this guy is a dogmatic, and if he just harps on one single issue.
Well, Charles touched upon.
Well, I'll give you an example.
Oh.
Go ahead. I was going to volunteer that I can just give you a little anecdote from my own life. I used to be a licensed attorney, and in 1997, I brought a series of civil rights lawsuits, seven different civil rights lawsuits against a Texas police department, all on behalf of white people, and it created an amazing storm. In the state of Texas, it was in Austin, which is the capital, and the storm went on for several months. And basically, the two federal judges who were hearing all these cases decided that the easiest way to deal with the problem was to get rid of me. And in the process of getting rid of me, it was made clear to me by agents of the FBI that the main reason that they wanted to get rid of me was because civil rights as laws were not designed to protect white people, and to use them to protect white people was basically to be a subversive and to attack the system as a whole, because if everybody had civil rights, it would be chaos. And to maintain order, it basically, civil rights were only a way of, you know, helping black people and Mexicans, and to use them for white people was basically the end of America. And that's basically the story, a very short version of how I lost my law license.
Hi, Charles, I fully agree.
And
with you. I mean, you have the same.
Well, I think Charles touched upon this, but Tom, I want to ask you about the elections in Europe and Marine Le Pen and the different political parties there. Do you view those parties, like the Front National and Jobbik and the BNP, do you view them as an extension of the European New Right?
Okay, I made the distinction at the beginning of our discussion between the intellectual involvement and political involvement. There is no question that many Jobbik people that I'm familiar with, that were next door, and even folks from the Front National that I'm also familiar with, have been influenced, have been affected by the ideas of the European New Right. But again, I must emphasize that the New Right per se is not a political party. It doesn't intend to be an electoral phenomenon. It's basically an intellectual phenomenon. And yes, there are some advisors. I mean, it's just a private wild guess, if I can put it that way. You probably never asked those people those questions. But they certainly have people in the shadow, if I can put it that way. Intellectuals, advisors from Marine Le Pen, and even the guys that I know of in the Jobbik party who surround Gabor Mona, who is their chief. I will be seeing him shortly in October. I have a big speech with Jared Taylor and Alexander Dugin in Budapest on the 3rd of October, and which this conference is sponsored by the Jobbik Party. And of course, there will be some sympathizers from the New Right, from all over Europe, and from all, yes, the gentleman, a good friend of mine from the NPI, will be there. Richard Spencer will be there as well as a speaker. Yeah, so the answer to your question is yes and no. The New Right is basically an intellectual movement which has had a considerable influence for on different nationalist, and even conservative parties all over Europe.
And what would you see as the North American extension of the New Right? I know that, like, this. Well, there was originally a. I think it started off on Facebook, a group that called itself the North American New Right. And I'm not sure if Countercurrents is the founder, but I know Countercurrents has taken up that mantle. They refer to themselves as the North American New Right.
Good point. I guess we should probably invite Greg Johnson, who is a good friend of mine from San Francisco, to come to our venue. Oh, good point. So if you have a chance, please do call him. He's doing a great job, no question about it. He has published some very good books on a, as I said, on this cultural, intellectual level. And yes, again, there are so many misunderstandings as far as this cluster words, New Right is concerned. But he's definitely flowing along this line of the New Right in Europe, and so is the NPI, this little think tank run by my friend Richard Spencer. And yes, you're right, American Freedom Party, that was probably one of the main reasons. We are very open-minded as far as the ideas are concerned. Kevin MacDonald and I, we share many things in common, not just on one single issue, but on different issues like European history, like European gene pool, if I can put it that way. And there is certainly a certain new rightish, under quotation marks, tendency within the American Freedom Party. We are not dogmatic. We are not just obsessed with one ethnicity. We are open to our European heritage. We are not pro-American or anti-European or anti-American. We are just open, and we basically our goal is to salvage our European heritage. That's very clean. And of course, unlike other intellectual movements, or including the Jared Taylor's American Renaissance, we are not just focused on one single issue, not just on the race or immigration or on the Jewish question. We are trying to expand our horizons of research. Charles mentioned a while ago all Southern agrarians. I would literally love, take my words for folks, I would love to give a lecture, not just one lecture, but the whole semester, just to talk about the Southern legacy. We want to expand our horizons from Mark Twain all the way to Henry Miller. He wrote some good books on Americanism as well. And well, you name it, you know. So basically, the American Freedom Party, the way I see it, of course, it's an activist party, and that's why I'm coming over to the States. We want to, of course, raise some funds and make it a little bit bigger and make it more modern, you know. But at the same time, we are proud of our legacy, and our legacy stretches not just to Europe. It stretches also, why not, and even to San Francisco and all those people. And basically, I myself, and you just got to, I have to explain that. I'm sick and tired of this white guilt. What do I have to be afraid of? What do I have to feel guilty about? You know, I'm just a law-abiding citizen, and all what I'm interested in is in bringing back our cultural heritage and making the world know that we are here.
I mean, I interviewed a former member of the American Third Position Party, American Freedom Party, named his name is Max Marco, and he actually left the party. He's now the chairman of the American branch of a party called the Renaissance Party of North America, and he basically said he left the party because he feels that the party's become, he views it as sort of just another reactionary right-wing party. Do you think that's a legitimate concern that it could become just sort of another sort of reactionary right-wing party that have tried and they failed in the past in America?
Absolutely. Listen, I can't speculate about the future, but unfortunately, there's always a danger with every political party. I myself will tell you, I haven't had a very positive opinion about the right-wing parties, be it in the United States of America or, for that matter, in Europe. Since the Second World War, I haven't seen a single political party, not an intellectual movement, political party which has truly been inspiring, which has truly laid out its plan in a very coherent fashion. And it just turned out into in a, it turned out to be a sham quite often. And for me, this remains a puzzling mystery. Why is that? Is it probably because of our egos? Because we know this, unfortunately, I hate to talk about this, but that's the fact of the matter. Never, ever have I seen so many egos and so much, self-centeredness as among right-wingers and nationalists in Europe and the United States of America. On the one hand, let's be critical, folks. On the one hand, we talk and we preach and we pontificate about community and how we have to preserve our community, our gene pool, after all. And yet, on the other hand, I've never seen so much extreme individualism as among right-wingers and nationalists in Europe, be it in Croatia or, for that matter, in San Francisco. But back to your point, yes, we're talking, let's folks dismiss this cluster word, new right. We're talking about the very specific sensibility, which is at the same time very archaic, very traditional, very conservative, and yet at the same time hyper-modern. Hence the reason I have nothing in common with the Republicans. Of course, there's some good people over there, or for that matter, with Democrats, with all those established parties. Hopefully, I sincerely hope so, that the American Freedom Party will open up new venues and will bring in more people. I mean, I myself, I feel just as comfortable talking about Schopenhauer, whom I read every evening. This is my bedtime literature. This great philosopher, German philosopher from the early 19th century. But I also feel very comfortable talking about the rock band, Lynyrd Skynyrd. I grew up with Lynyrd Skynyrd, with the Grateful Dead, and I can talk just as well about the about different Screwdriver, all those anti-communist rock music. So I have no problems with that. So basically, what the American Freedom Party is all about, it's a combination of our ancestry, but at the same time, we want to project it in the future, but always in a law-abiding and good fashion. All those tattoos, all those, crazy people walking around getting drunk or being high on crack, forget it. I got those people are doing harm to us. I don't want to have any business with those guys.
So we have about 10 minutes left towards the top of the hour. I want to touch upon the Beverly Hills event. So this is Tom Sununu's giving a speech, but this is sort of a project of Charles. Charles has an interest specifically in a detente. Charles, could you explain what you're trying to get at by this? Because I know you organized this event, and you organize and you have this theme on top of Sunak's speech. Charles, can you explain what you hope to achieve?
Well, it's really part of the reason that I'm affiliated with the Beverly Hills GEM Community Center at all. Its owner, its manager, is a Jewish rabbi by the name of Rabbi Herzl Eluliun, and basically he.
Do you have a specific title at the GEM Center so far?
I do. It sounds much grander than it is. I am called the director of development there. The basic goal was there was basic goal was fundraising. But when Rabbi Eluliun met me, I mean, this is again is a very long digression, but he asked me, among other things, why do people hate Jews? He asked me that just straight out. And it's an interesting question. He knew from one of his congregation, but I affiliate with a lot of people who sort of have that reputation of disliking Jews, it's a little bit embarrassing, but it's also a real social issue all over the world, I guess. And I was taken back by the frankness of the question at first, but my answer was, well, Jews control Hollywood. And his first reaction to that was, well, so what? And I said, well, Hollywood, and by that I mean, of course, the mainstream media, television, the movies, Hollywood is destroying America. And I think that gets sort of to the heart of what we're talking about, the traditional values that the new right is trying to preserve, as Dr. Sunak is explaining. And basically, Eluliun was sort of taken aback by that frank answer, and he said, well, you're right. And he's a very, you know, he's a very traditional moralist himself. He believes in, you know, upright behavior and moral integrity. And he's caught in a lot of difficult situations being out here in Beverly Hills, Hollywood, modern, basically the modern version of Sodom and Gomorrah, without any doubt. And what can you do when you're talking between two traditions that want to preserve, in essence, a common core of tradition, traditional values? And, you know, you were talking about Schopenhauer, and you're talking about Nietzsche and Ezra Pound, and up to a point, all of these, all traditionalists, I think, up to a point, look back to the 19th century, the period. We were in the centennial year of World War One, and I think everybody looks back to the time before World War One as the last gasp of the traditional world. Would you say that's true?
I absolutely agree with you, Charles. I absolutely agree with you, Charles. That's a good point you made.
And the interesting thing about the period before World War One, from a Christian-Jewish standpoint, is there was no major anti-Semitism anywhere in Europe. Whether you like that term or not, there were no major events in anti-Semitism, except possibly in Russia. But in Western Europe, basically, in Germany, in Austria, in France, in England, Jews were becoming part of the mainstream. And as a matter of fact, typically they were affiliating with the conservative side. You know, one of my favorite examples is Benjamin Disraeli, the first and so far only Jewish prime minister of England ever, you know, prime minister of the United Kingdom. He was the man who created the political reality of the British Empire by crowning Victoria with the title Empress of India. That was a very conservative act. It was completely consistent with Cecil Rhodes' concept of white man's burden and of Europe as a civilizing agent around the world. And something happened in World War One where the old demons, if you want to call them that, of, you know, enmity between Jewish and Christian people came back alive. And the great symbol of that, of course, became World War Two and the Nazi movement in Germany. And you know, there's a lot of reason to think, and I assume that this is one of your taboo topics in Croatia. There's a lot of reason to think that a mythology has grown up around the events of the Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, and that is the most interesting taboo on free speech I think anywhere in the world right now. Is that in Europe? It is in many parts of Europe. It is an out and out crime, as David Irving found out the hard way, to be a Holocaust revisionist, as they say. And I think that we need to bridge the gap between basically people like us who believe in a traditional Europe and a traditional European civilization here in America, and people like Rabbi Ilulian, who have, in essence, the same values, even though they basically they go to a different church.
What's interesting about Rabbi Ilulian is he's actually originally from Iran, so he doesn't have the whole history with Europe that I think creates a lot of these controversies, because he's not from Europe. Would you say that's accurate?
Well, I mean, his family is from Iran. He actually, and I think he was born in Iran, but he actually grew up in Milano. He grew up in Milan, Italy, and so he's very in tune with the European scene. He's really a wonderful gentleman, and he's really one of the most interesting gentlemen I have met in Los Angeles, in terms of his cultural erudition and his moral integrity and his dedication to very traditional values. I mean, in this city of Los Angeles, it's really remarkable to think of anyone opposing, promiscuous sexuality openly. I mean, promiscuous sexuality is what makes Los Angeles Los Angeles. And to have a rabbi in the middle of Beverly Hills standing up and saying, no, promiscuity is wrong, homosexuality is wrong, these are the laws of God, these are the laws of the Bible. I mean, he basically sounds like a Southern Baptist preacher in terms of his values.
Charles, would and, they say, so the where you go to All Saints Episcopal in Beverly Hills, would the priest there, would he openly say the same things?
No, he certainly wouldn't. He All Saints is and again we're going to get way off topic. We stopped talking about modern Episcopal Church. I think that we should let the last few words be to Tom and say,
okay.
Do you think that it's possible to bridge the gap created by World War II between Jews and Christians as purveyors of traditional values? Do you think it's possible for us to work together to build up the remnants of European civilization, preserve what's good? And do you think this is a good place to start?
I presume I've implicitly stated that in my first argument, in my first statements, folks. That's why I've joined the American Freedom Party, and I think we have to work on a better understanding between different nations and different races. But if we cater to each other, if we pretend, if we use the mendacious type of a talk, or like catering to the Jews, or just making fun of them, or just pretending to be more Jewish than the Jews themselves, it's certainly a it's not a good start. It actually leads to opposite consequences. And I'm sure I'll be happy to address this issue of anti-Semitism and this false identity often displayed by many Christian Zionists, not just in the States, but also here in Europe. But unfortunately, folks, I will have to sign off, but I would love indeed to tackle this issue of Judaism and monotheism, in fact, even modern anti-Semitism and even Nazism, and how actually it reflects itself its hidden anti-Semitic feelings among most Europeans, who, for a variety of reasons, of course, don't want to state it alone openly. And I'm really fascinated, Charles, what you just said. I guess this is something I always keep in mind, the moral integrity. You know, this is something what I always, before I talk to anybody, and regardless whether he's a Jewish guy or a dog worshiper or a Wotanist or Odinist, whatever, I first and foremost look at his moral integrity. And that's how I actually gauge my interlocutors and gauge the people I talk to. And thank you very much, folks. I appreciate that. But please do apologize me because I have to run some other errands. But I'm definitely at your service. And I'm looking forward to meeting Charles and Robert, both of you, and other friends as well. And please do, guys, plug in and make sure, advertise our event as much as possible. So we get some. I'm mostly interested in, it doesn't have to be big-time intellectuals, just students, people who would like to learn something. And I intend to present my lectures in a very sober and unbiased and very objective fashion without taking any sides.
I'd like to thank
That'd be great.
I'd like to thank Tom Sunick and Charles Lincoln for joining us. We are out of time. That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.